You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Hi, good evening, everybody. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation. I want to welcome you to our first in the series of Dreams, Genes, and Machines. Are we living science fiction? The title says it all. We seem to be moving closer and closer to the lives we read about or saw in science fiction novels and movies. In the next several months, with the help of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, we'll be delving into the pressing issues in science. Our hope is that these programs will expose you to research on the cutting edge in gene editing, infrastructure, and AI. For those who don't know the Library Foundation, it's a nonprofit that provides vital support to the Los Angeles Public Library through fundraising and engagement. This allows for the incredible programs that are free and open to millions of adults and children, like Live Homework Help and Adult Literacy and College Prep, and programs like this one. Next week, the Foundation is hosting Ta-Nehisi Coates with Ryan Coogler at the West Angeles Church, and later in the month, Daniel Mendelsohn and Richard Kramer at the Kirk Douglas Theater. If you're interested in helping support all our work, please check out the table in the lobby. We'd love to see you. And let me introduce our next guests. Dr. April Pyle is a professor at UCLA in the Department of Microbiology, Immunology, and Molecular Genetics. Her lab researches therapeutic approaches for patients with muscular dystrophy by using cell therapies. She will be able to explain, as I was reading her bio, with much more authority and detail, her extraordinary work. She will be in discussion with Karen Kaplan, the science and medicine editor for the LA Times. Please welcome our two guests. Thank you very much.
Thanks to everybody for turning out tonight. I'm Karen. This is April, by process of elimination. And it's heartening to see so many people willing to come out on a weeknight and think about science. I find that very gratifying. So thanks for coming out. So we're going to start with the basics. April, people have probably heard the term gene editing, or maybe CRISPR out there. Can you just start by explaining what exactly that is and why anybody would want to do it?
Yeah, so CRISPR is a mouthful, clustered regularly interspaced palindromic repeats. And CRISPR is a new technology that really has developed over many labs and many interesting studies of the genome. In fact, all of the pieces of DNA that come together that are paired by bases, A pairs with T, G pairs with C, and this makes the DNA double helix. And it turns out that there's a mechanism called CRISPR by which we can actually edit the genome. And this actually was something that, you know, kind of was, we'll talk about, pieced together by many different scientists. And so it's a way to really take advantage of the components of, in fact, it was recently discovered by the bacterial systems to actually edit pieces and prevent against invading bacteria. And then we actually, many scientists translated it to be able to edit the in mammalian cells.
Well, even before CRISPR, there were attempts to edit genes in for human cells. And why would that be useful?
So one of the things as scientists we do is we try and study. So we have the sequence of the human genome, but we're often trying to uncover what each of the genes are, what regulates these genes. And there's actually not that many gene coding DNA sequences. And so we use CRISPR as a tool to study what these genes do in mammalian and living cells. And so we actually use this as a tool to study which genes actually are important for making specific cell types in your body, in neurons, muscle cells, heart cells. And when we can turn genes on and off, we can actually understand how to make these cells and how actually this happens in development.
So if you knock out a gene so that it's not able to work, then you can see when the system is going, what it's not doing anymore, and that gives you a clue what the gene
actually
does when it's working?
Absolutely. So that's what we do in the lab, is we try and target specific genes, and CRISPR is a tool to do that so that we can uncover, if we don't have it, then this cell can't make this particular product or move or turn into this cell type. And then we know that gene is critical for that process in the lab. And so it's kind of a really important tool to be able to study what all of the genes in the cell are doing.
So how is it that CRISPR makes it easier to use gene editing in the lab compared to previous systems? Or, you know, what is, why do people get all worked up about CRISPR?
Right. So this CRISPR wasn't the first system to really be able to edit genes. There were other systems before this. But what makes CRISPR so unique is that it's one of these things in science, when you have a tool that is really easy to use, it kind of takes over and takes off, and everyone, really any scientist, can pick up the ability to do this in the lab. And the reason that is because it uses the information in the DNA to be able to specifically target that with an intermediate species called RNA. And this makes it actually very efficient to do. And so it's something that is really just, it used to take months and months to be able to clone, to be able to do these different things in other methods with, by cloning, I mean DNA. But this is now, you don't have to do that anymore with CRISPR. You can just design short sequences, find out where these align with the DNA in the cell, and then you can manipulate these genes very straightforward.
So it sounds like there'd probably be uses of gene editing that people wouldn't be using if it weren't for CRISPR. It would just be too much work. They wouldn't bother.
It's true. I mean, it's also that one of the things that, because it's so easy to do, you can target not one gene, but multiple genes. So you can target 10 at one time. You can target, you know, many more than that. In certain labs really are targeting 20 or more, just so you can get an idea. Because of the ease of this, you can actually do it and target many more genes at once, which you couldn't in previous technologies.
So how do you use CRISPR in your research about muscular dystrophy?
So my lab studies a devastating skeletal muscle disease. It's called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And this is in about 1 in 5,000 boys. It's a mutation in the largest gene in the genome, which is called dystrophin. These boys have a mutation in this gene that actually renders them, you know, not able to use their muscles, and so they become wheelchair bound in their teens, and there is no cure. They usually don't live past their 20s. And so at UCLA and the Broad Stem Cell Center, as well as the Center for Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy, we have access to patients that have Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And when I interface with these patients, I wanted to be able to really make a difference in their lives and eventually find a cure. And so my background is in human pluripotent stem cells. So we are a stem cell lab. We've always, you know, thought about stem cells. And so what we can do actually, and what we do in the lab, is we take patients in the clinic that have Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and we take a skin cell. So we just take one of their skin cells. We take it back to the lab, and then we change these skin cells into a stem cell. It's called a pluripotent stem cell. Now we have a stem cell line of the patients. And so we can study, you know, once we differentiate these into affected cell types, mainly in these patients, skeletal muscle and cardiomyocytes in the heart, we can study how these cells function. But what was interesting is that, obviously, even still being able to do this, you still have the patient's own mutations. And so I thought, if we're really going to make a difference, we have to find a way to change the patient's mutations back to the wild type or to a normal dystrophin protein. And so that's what I embarked on. I did this in collaboration with the Melissa Spencer at UCLA. We had a shared graduate student who did this work, Courtney Young. And so what we did was, we thought, can we actually use this CRISPR approach, which again enables you to edit the genome to change a mutant dystrophin protein into a protein that was functional? So restore the dystrophin protein. And one of the things we did was actually seems sort of strange, but we actually found a region in the patients where there was the most mutations, and we just cut out with CRISPR this whole mutation region. And then what the cells do is they piece back together the DNA to make a functional protein again. And so what we've been able to do in the lab is take patients' own cells. We use CRISPR to correct the mutation such that they have a functional dystrophin protein now. And now we're studying actually how to translate this to patients with Duchenne. And so this actually is one of the most challenging aspects, is thinking about how to really move this forward. So it's one of these times in science where the technology really is, you know, advancing what we can do, and now we have to really figure out what's the best way to move this forward in a safe manner for patients.
So you don't have to take out a piece of DNA and replace it with the correct gene. Just taking out the part that's messed up is enough?
Yeah, so it's actually counterintuitive, because what we can do is actually delete out the whole mutation region. So we just take this CRISPR platform, which again enables you to, you know, edit the DNA, and we take out the whole mutation region, and then we can piece it back together. And in fact, the cell does that because they have the endogenous machinery to do that on its own. And so current approaches typically deliver back genes. And so this is, when you do this, this is called gene therapy. And this is a transient approach, because it doesn't integrate into the DNA. And what we're doing is actually, you know, targeting in the DNA itself, so we can actually just cut out and remove the mutation. And so this is a lifelong strategy, whereas when you do gene therapy, where you deliver back a new gene, this is often transient. And so in the lab, what we're doing now is trying to figure out how to deliver the CRISPR machinery in vivo to directly edit patients' muscles in a safe manner. And alternatively, as I said, we have stem cells from the patients that we can actually, in the lab, cut the mutated region out, piece back together, differentiate into muscle and cardiomyocytes, and give those cells back. So those are two different routes of delivery that we're currently comparing.
So every cell, pretty much, in your body has your entire nuclear DNA. Do you have to correct it in every single cell, or does CRISPR only have to hit a certain number of cells for this to work?
It's a great question. What we need to target are the affected cell types. In Duchenne, this is skeletal muscle, so it's all the muscle in your body, and then the heart. And so that's the challenge, is being able to just target those affected cell types and not other cell types. And so how much do you need is still a question that we're trying to understand in the lab. We think that you need is, even for Duchenne, so for these patients, they don't have any of this critical protein. And so any protein is better than none. And so what level do you need to get to completely restore functional gain? We think at least 10 to 15%. And that's I think something that the goal we're trying to strive for, at least initially. But yeah, you ask an important question, like how to make sure that, you know, you're specifically targeting your therapy to those specific cell types, and that's something that we're working on.
And is the idea that you would only have to do it once then, or if it kind of wears off, you know, could you just do it again, you know, every 6 months, get an infusion, or however it would work?
Well, so in with CRISPR, if you're targeting the genome, in theory, if it was efficient enough, you would only have to do it once. Whereas in gene therapy approaches, you're delivering back a gene that's not the real in the DNA. It's a gene that you're delivering, and it's not in your DNA. And so in that case, you may have to do multiple deliveries. The problem with the current strategies is if they do, the gene therapy will elicit an immune response. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that is a concern for re-delivery. And so if CRISPR is efficient enough, and you fix the mutation, or, you know, in our case, you delete out the mutated region, then the hope is that you would only have to You know, really do that once. And then the other challenge is really in muscle. Muscle's a regenerative organ, and so it's meaning that it's always making new muscle. And there's a cell that's called the stem cell in the muscle. And if we could target that cell, then we could have a lifelong cure, because that's the cell in the muscle that actually repairs muscle over time after injury. And so that's really the key target, is getting that stem cell for a lifelong cure.
So in using CRISPR, would you always start with the patient's own DNA and change that so that what you're giving back, their body won't think it's like a foreign tissue and try to reject it?
Yeah, this is a really big challenge in the field, is overcoming, you know, our bodies are smart and they see something foreign and they're always going to mount an immune response. And so this is always the battle of trying to fix this mutation and prevent the immune response. And so if you do the stem cell route, where you take the patient's own cells, you do a correction. And what's beautiful about taking the patient's own cells is that in theory, if you have the patient's own cells, then they may not reject that. But still the challenge remains is that these patients have never made this missing protein, dystrophin. And so even if they make that, we don't know, you know, how much the body's going to mount a response just to that protein.
No, because they've never seen it before.
Wow. And so that's still a challenge. And so I think for all of these therapies, we'll have to first start with a low amount, the immune response, mm-hmm. while we do the therapy until mm-hmm. this protein can be recognized.
So is there a thought where someday there would be just like an off-the-shelf medicine that you would give to anybody, or would it always be personalized? Is this an example of personalized medicine?
This is an example of personalized medicine that we're doing in the lab with the stem cells. However, if you take the alternative route, which we're also working on, which is direct delivery of the CRISPR in vivo, this would target 50% of patients. And so patients that have Duchenne muscular dystrophy, they have a region in the DNA that we call a hotspot, where there's a lot of patients have mutations in this region. And so if you target that specific region, then you can target 50% of patients. And so in that case, if you do direct delivery strategies, you wouldn't need, you know, for every time to make the patient's own stem cells.
How young are patients diagnosed with muscular dystrophy? And in theory, if you, you know, could you get this therapy to somebody at a young enough age where their body would just grow up with it and then they would live essentially normal life?
I mean, this is the hope. So patients, unfortunately, because dystrophin is the largest gene that we make, they can have mutations throughout. And so there's no clinical test that we can do to really see that there's mutation in dystrophin. It's not a common a genetic test that mm-hmm. we do. And so the only way that you know is when it's X-linked, so it's mainly boys are affected, is that they actually have walking delays. Often they have motor skill delays. And you typically see it around age 2 or 3. And then there's a test that you can do to see they have elevated stress enzyme, and it's can be diagnosed on a real genetic test. But it's often not seen until patients are a little bit older, but still targeting it at 2 to 3 would be remarkable for the patients. So the younger the better.
The younger the better. You know, it would stick more, or you would...
It's just that it's something that you might be able to get the delivery strategy to every cell that you need at that age.
And just to give an appreciation of CRISPR, I mean, this is still years away, I assume, from being...
Well, it's not years away.
From being a therapy that, like, somebody would go to their doctor and say, my son has muscular dystrophy, and this would be the...
Oh, this for Duchenne muscular dystrophy in particular? Yeah. So the CRISPR strategy for Duchenne muscular dystrophy is something that we're working on. Two other labs are also working on, and we have a 5-year plan mm-hmm. to really move it forward.
And at the end of the 5 years, this would be in a clinical trial?
No, that we're hoping to start a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how many of you in the audience know much about medicine, but 5 years sounds like a long time if you're the parent of a child with a disease,
it's
but it's actually pretty fast
in the clinical
as
world,
a scientist. So just to give an appreciation of how much of a shortcut CRISPR is giving you, if you didn't have CRISPR, what would be, you know, what's the alternate stem cell version of trying to treat muscular dystrophy or cure it?
So there is no cure, and there is no other avenue. The only avenue really is for to dampen the immune response, mm-hmm. and that's the current standard of treatment for boys with Duchenne. Mm-hmm. So there are current clinical trials using gene therapy, and so there's three different clinical trials overexpressing genes in the cells, so overexpressing dystrophin in the cells, and these are ongoing, and so these are looking promising, but these we don't know the how long the gene therapy is going to work. And so it's a question of, because muscle is such a turnover tissue, we always have to worry about how long is this going to last. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a permanent correction in the DNA, you can target the stem cells, you potentially have a lifelong strategy. That's our hope anyway.
Are there any therapies that are currently available to patients that were made possible by CRISPR?
So that's what I was saying, is that CRISPR is not far away in the sense yeah. that this year there's a number of trials that will be starting. And the first of these will be using hematopoietic stem cells. So basically you take the blood stem cells and you can actually CRISPR engineer those cells and then give them back to patients. And I think some of the first will be in cancer-based strategies where you're really engineering these cells to better able to attack the cancer.
That's immunotherapy you're talking
mm-hmm,
about?
Mm-hmm. With CRISPR. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that I think will move forward first.
Mm-hmm. And is that, what makes that farther along? Is there something about blood stem cells that's easier to deal with? Or is it that if you're a cancer patient, you have fewer alternatives, and so people are more willing to try things?
It's because the hematopoietic stem cell has been really the godfather of stem cells. We know a lot about, it's either easy to isolate, so we can isolate the blood stem cells easily, and because of that, we've in the lab studied for a long time how to get things into the cells, and CRISPR is one of those that we've really spent a lot of time thinking about how to engineer the hematopoietic stem cells. And then you can transplant these back to patients, and that's been done routinely mm-hmm. In cancer-based strategies for a long time. And so this is just then making a permanent change mm-hmm. in the stem cell and then giving that back. So it's just followed many years of research on how to manipulate the endogenous hematopoietic or blood stem cell.
I presume there are some of you in this audience who maybe first heard of CRISPR with regard to these twin babies born in China. How many of you guys heard of that story? Right, okay, so for those who aren't familiar, the claim is that this couple wanted to protect their children from ever being infected with HIV. And the idea is that if they could knock out this one particular gene, the HIV would not have a way to ever get into their cells. And so this scientist was using CRISPR to try to knock out the CCR5 gene. And it was done in a way where nobody asked for permission in advance, and these two girls were born last year that, if you believe them, you know, were subjected to CRISPR before they were, you know, IVF treatment. They were put in the mother's uterus. So we've got at least potentially two people walking around whose DNA has been edited by CRISPR. First of all, it seems like a laudable goal to try to protect your kid from having HIV. I don't know how much of a threat it is where they live in particular, but what's so bad about that?
I mean, so many, on so many levels. It's like, had to breathe through this. It's really, you know, there's so many levels of where this went wrong. And one of them is that the patients weren't really on any level, or the
patients being the girl,
mom,
babies,
or the mom, or on the any level, okay. Like no consent was obtained. And as scientists, we go through rigorous hoops to be able to move anything forward on every level, and we're held to high standards by many committees. the where we do the science that we do is safe and it's going to have a positive outcome. And that's something that they didn't do, first of all. So that was really the scientific community, I think, is, you know, in shock that they would even, you know, attempt to do it. Second, I don't study CCR5, but my understanding in the literature, in the scientific literature and by scientists who do, is that there was no guarantee and there wasn't scientific evidence that even changing this particular gene would have any real effect on HIV transmission. So then there wasn't appropriate scientific justification for doing this. And third, that the patients, because the dad had HIV, not the mom, that there wasn't even like, you know, there wasn't a severe need at this point. And so for many levels, on every level, it wasn't done appropriately. And so then the fourth level is that this work was never published in the scientific literature. And we always go through really extensive reviews when we publish our work. And this is a way that scientists can see what we're doing and tell us, hey, you didn't think about this. And so we have a lot of feedback from other scientists in the community through this process of peer review. So this work has never been no one's actually really seen what was done. It's not published. We don't have access to the data other than, you know, what has been shown in meetings, but it wasn't, you know, I didn't undergo real rigorous review. And so it's hard for me to know, honestly, what actually was done.
Mm-hmm. But I'm saying all this is kind of like allegedly.
Allegedly, right? So I think there's a lot of hype, and I think we don't really have the evidence to know. But one thing you can be sure is that, you know, as scientists, we are carefully weighing the pros and cons of what should be done and are having these discussions in the scientific communities at large. And this is something that we think about routinely and will be kind of, I think, a question for society to think about moving forward.
Well, you talked about how we don't know for sure that the potential upside of this alleged therapy was all it's cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm.
What about the downsides? What could go wrong if you start tinkering with, with CRISPR, if you're focusing just on one gene, mm-hmm. how badly could things go?
Yeah. So this, I think, is something that we should clarify, right? So there's different cell types in your body. One are somatic cells, which are all of the cells in your body. And then there are germ cells, which are the sperm and egg. This work was done in after sperm and egg fusion, you make the first zygote, which turns into the first embryo. And these experiments were done, you know, early in development, which means that any cell type that we call this germline editing, any cell type that you edit there has the potential to affect many subsequent generations. Right. So this is the problem that we evolutionarily any type of editing in the germline has the potential to have consequences throughout generations from there. Whereas what we are talking about in the lab is more somatic editing, right, in other cells, adult cells in the body, in particular muscle in the heart. And so that's going to be for that patient to cure that disease. So the consequences are that you could have subsequent generations that are affected. So this could have many different consequences, evolutionary and otherwise. But also the technology, as I said, we're still vetting it. And so CRISPR we need to make sure that there's no other genes, not just the gene that you're anticipating that you're targeting, but other genes are also not affected. And so this is something that, you know, we routinely look at every gene in the genome. We call this whole genome, and we do whole analysis of every gene to make sure that there's no other genes that were targeted. And so this is something, I guess, number 12 on the list that was not performed appropriately.
You know, going back to the distinction between the somatic cells and the germ cells.
Yeah.
When the day comes, there could be a therapy for these muscular dystrophy patients. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be nice if the mutation was corrected and a patient would not have to worry about bothering a child with the same mutation and the same problem.
So this is going to be a next level challenge, I think, to really think about this, and I think it's going to be a very special decision that will have to be weighed in every circumstance and case. And so I think for any aspect of germline editing, I think that it will have to be rigorously evaluated. I think that there should be multiple levels of evaluation of this, and I think it's something that, you know, I think will have to be carefully considered.
And if the patient's two or three at the time, they can't make that decision. I guess the parents, for a little kid, it doesn't seem crazy to have the parent make the decision for them. But like, what if it's something that comes up when you're a teenager? You know, who should get to make that decision about changing their DNA and of their potentially for their children and grandchildren?
Right. I think that this is something that will have to be. I don't think anyone is in favor of germline editing at this point, because we don't understand the consequences. Mm-hmm. And so I think that as we better understand how this technology works, what the potential issues could be with editing the genome, then we'll have to come back to this and think about how to really deal with some of these decisions once we know. Currently, I think it's not even an option on the table.
Right. So you touched on this earlier about the long backstory to the development of CRISPR, that it is an adaptive immune system response for bacteria or microbes to protect themselves against invading viruses. Mm-hmm. So how on earth did somebody look inside a microbe and see the machinery it used to protect itself from viruses and think, we could put that in mammals and use it not just to protect mammals from viruses, but to edit their DNA?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is one of the most fascinating stories, and I think it's something that's often overlooked as what happens in science, is that often in science, it's not just one discovery. It's multiple discoveries. We build off of other discoveries as scientists. And this case is a beautiful case in point. So as we were sequencing the genome, there was a scientist actually who became interested in understanding, he was interested in understanding how bacteria are different in different climates, and how some could survive better than others and under different extreme conditions. And so he sequenced these bacteria, and he actually found these strange repeats of sequences in the DNA. And he didn't know really what these were there for. But he, published his work on this, and then someone else picked this up and was thinking about it. In another region of the world, there were scientists who were actually trying to understand how to make better dairy products, yogurt, and other things. And there's constant battle between bacteria and viruses. And so it's this constant struggle where they're always trying to win out. And in this case, what happened is that the bacteria were trying to prevent viruses, from invading. And what they ended up doing was actually taking a piece of the viral DNA and inserting it into their own genome. So this is something that bacteria, it was an immune response that the bacteria acquired to try and resist viral invasion. And so they actually, kept record of these invasions in the cell. And then that way, once the virus comes back in, they can mount a response and actually immediately prevent further virus entry. And so it was these basic discoveries that actually we got CRISPR out of these basic discoveries, which is, I think, phenomenal, because as a society, we need to remember that basic science is really important. And so answering basic science questions is still where we have to be. We have to be, looking at basic science as well as translational aspects to really move any medical breakthroughs forward. And so all of this work was published, and then many famous scientists who I'm sure you're a CRISPR fan, you've heard of.
Get your trading cards out.
Yeah. Who then really saw this amazing ability of, you know, kind of the system and said, well, can we use this in mammalian cells? So not in bacteria, but actually in, you know, human cells. Can we adapt the system? And they worked for many years to try and tweak the way the bacteria do it and to get it to work in human cells. And it turns out that it's really just based on recognition of, you know, in the one that's the most commonly used, three base pairs, three nucleotides in which this CRISPR system works. And so it very quickly exploded. And that's why, you know, it, because of the simplicity of the system that that so many labs can use it.
My two favorite parts of the story are, and there are many things to love about this, but that the person it started with, who was studying these extreme microbes, was from Spain at a maybe medium-level university, and he was, there's a lot of salt marshes around there, a lot of salty areas, and only because in his local environment was a salty environment an issue that he was even asking this question in the first place. So it was very, very specific. Maybe eventually somebody somewhere else would have come up with this similar question, but it's, you know, just kind of looking out your window and thinking, what problem is there for me to look into?
Right.
And then the second thing is that the first generation of these papers where things were, of these studies where things were slowly coming together and becoming the building blocks of CRISPR, even when the scientists kind of had an inkling that, you know, someday this could have relevance for, you know, altering DNA, they submitted these papers to like the most prestigious journals that are the ones we write about in the media, and they all got rejected because
all the basic discoveries just got rejected. It was unbelievable.
Partly it was because they weren't from fancy universities, we suspect. You know, even when it was like clear what the implication were, you know, they say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and people just weren't ready for it at the time. And you know, who knows how many people are not getting tenure because their papers aren't getting published in prestigious journals, which is preventing them from getting grants. And
so
these poor guys.
I mean, just basic observation is science now. I mean, I think sometimes it's overlooked. And so, you know, really, I really encourage everyone in my lab to just sit and look at your cells. Like, what are they doing? I mean, this is the first thing you should be doing every day when you come into the lab is really observation and thinking about what you see, and then imagining that you can take it to another level. And I think that's something that all of these scientists did, building off of excitement and really sharing knowledge at meetings. This work is unpublished.
Yeah, it's like you could draw a family tree of like how this person met this person in the chain, and they went to a conference, and then this link in the chain comes in, and if it weren't for them all talking to each other.
It's right. And so that's, you know, why it's important just to share knowledge and you know, communicate with others in the field so that you can make better, you know, discoveries and make those connections.
It kind of reminds me of hearing about the space program and how we have Tang and tinfoil because we went to the moon, you know?
Exactly.
All right. Well, we were told to leave some time for questions. And here we are coming around with a microphone.
Hi. I was wondering what would be like the ramifications like those two kids in China, what's the odds that they could have a mutated gene if they reproduced? Like what? I mean, I know it's kind of early in that stage, but
well, so you know, as I said, we're not really. I mean, you haven't seen, you know, any real scientific application, so we don't really know what was done. But assuming that they mutated CCR5, you have to also wonder. Did they also target any other gene, right? And so that could have implications, you know, for how these cells, when you target any gene, it changes how a cell behaves. And then that could change, you know, how they are, you know, health-wise over their lifespan. So they should be carefully monitored. But two, the consequences are that this then mutation has an ability that gives it a selective advantage, if you will, and then that, you know, makes some change in the population if they continue to carry on that mutation reproduction after, you know. So it could have a selective advantage if there's a mutation that's selective.
So along with talks like these for the general public, what are other ways do you think scientists could improve how they're communicating their science to the general public? Just so like people hear gene editing and they can feel comfortable like asking questions about it and not just be like, oh, that's terrifying. I'm just gonna be very afraid of that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that as scientists, we tend to like stay in our space a little bit more and work on the experiments. And, you know, we need to get out of that box to communicate better. So in the LA Times, having, you know, interface with journalists, communicating, speaking at meetings. I think I try and talk to, you know, everyone I can at the school. I have the school out to the lab. I have, you know, at community events. And so really just getting out there and discussing this, I think is really important. And so I think there's a number of different avenues that we could do, but I think it's something you have to encourage scientists to do.
Well, and I think since the last presidential election, we've certainly seen scientists speaking up more and having their voices heard. Maybe they're not specifically going into great detail about their own work, but just talking up the advantages of using science and facts to guide you as you make decisions about policy or, you know, how choices we make for priorities as a country. And I don't know how much this would spill over into specific scientific topics that are kind of hot button, like vaccines or genetically modified organisms, but certainly I think it's forcing and motivating a certain subset of scientists to be more public about and speak up with their expertise for those who still value it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we have in California actually is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And so this is something that you all should be aware of, is really just enabled a lot of these breakthroughs and discoveries. And you as voters, you know, voted this in.
That was Proposition 71 back.
Prop 71. Yeah. It's going to be back in the ballot in 2020. So please go vote for stem cell research. Yep. I don't know who's.
Or do they have to be on the microphone? Yeah.
So when it comes to studies that are being published, how much has the vaccine autism connection study, which got published, I think, in Nature, what, 10 or 20 years ago?
I think it was in Lancet.
Yeah, okay. How much has that set back kind of the validity of these studies, or does it demonstrate how much harm one study can do and that carries through to this day?
Well, you know, it's funny we're talking about this before we started. Mm-hmm. There are some people who, even though that study has been totally discredited and Andrew Wakefield, who wrote it, even said he faked the data, there are still people who cling to the, you know, that study as if it were true. In the time that I've been a science reporter, there were those cloning studies in science that were turned out to be faked data too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most things, I mean, peer review is an imperfect process and it's good for catching kind of small mistakes, but it's not very good for catching like flat out fraud. You know, if you're going to make up the data, it's all going to match. I think, you know, from the general public, which, you know, we interface with a lot as readers, you know, there are people who are going to be skeptical of anything that just doesn't match with their worldview, and that'll be the argument they make if it's available to them, that how can you trust anything? But for the most part, I think people really are looking to science for, you know, to help them and make their lives better, whether it's a medical cure or a solution to climate change or, you know, whatever it might be. And, you know, they're willing to go along with the establishment. And, you know, a good thing about science is, you know, they don't pretend that if there's a mistake, it's going to be out there. You can't just deny it and have it have that work. You know, it will continue to be a mistake until you acknowledge it and correct it. And so the culture is very much to correct things.
Could you clarify why, as you explained, the muscular dystrophy is caused by the absence of a protein, and how, if you do CRISPR and you get rid of the abnormal mutation, you still don't have the proper protein, right?
Well, so it's an excellent question. So we actually take out the mutation region, and then, so as I said in science, you know, we build off of others, and there's been at least 10 years of work by many labs showing that actually that protein, that is the we call it a truncated or a shorter protein. So you do make the dystrophin protein; it's just smaller. That protein can still function as a dystrophin would, even though it's missing the middle region. It turns out that the middle region of the protein has these repeats, and that you don't need them all. And so others have shown that actually you can remove this repeat and the protein is still functional. But we call this a Becker muscular dystrophy. So it switches it from the full to a truncated protein. And Becker muscular dystrophy patients oftentimes don't even know they have a dystrophy. They come into the clinic sometimes in their 60s and realize that they had shortness of breath or perhaps, you know, some issues, you know, when they were younger in gym class, and then that they live a full life. And so it's taking a Duchenne and turning it into a Becker, which we call that, actually still enables the dystrophin protein to be made. It's just smaller.
So the dystrophin protein, there's a particular gene that makes it.
Dystrophin.
Right. And when that gene is not working because it's got this mutation, that's what prevents it from making the protein.
That's right.
And so if you can change up that gene so that it's not malfunctioning, then the body can kind of go back to the state it should have been in the first place, roughly, and make that replacement. Does that help you?
Yeah, because it's still, now you're making a smaller one, but it's still able to function. And so its role is to stabilize the cell. And so it can still do that job. Yes, yes. It's just smaller. Yeah.
Hi. There was a story on NPR this morning about CRISPR being used for sickle cell. And I was wondering, for diseases like leukemia, where the treatment right now is to kill off the bone marrow and transplant healthy bone marrow or stems, would that be a good application for something with CRISPR technology?
Absolutely. So there are a number of different avenues, as you mentioned, sickle cell being one, where if you can just change that, that one's even a little bit more straightforward. If you can change that specific mutation in the hematopoietic stem cells of the patients and then give those back, then you have a population of blood cells that, you know, have the correct gene. And so the same would be true in types of cancer studies, I think, as well, that if you can actually, if there's a single change that you can make and then give these back to the patients, and then that could have an avenue. And the first thing that's moving forward is really engineering a subclass of cells that can go and attack the cancer. But you're right, it would be ideal to fix a specific mutation in the cancer cells and then give those back to the patients. The problem with cancer is that often it's not one gene but multiple. But as I said, we're getting better and better at targeting multiple genes using CRISPR. So I think it's something that is definitely being evaluated.
And also with a case like sickle cell or even muscular dystrophy, you would want to be able to deliver these new genes without having to wipe out the whole immune system first, because that is really, really risky, and it's not guaranteed that when you get the new bone marrow that it is going to take, even if it's from the same patient. So there's other genetic traits, something called gene drives and other technologies where you would, without having to kill off the old stem cell, you know, the old genome, you could just put in the new cells and hopefully it would spread, and like these ones would multiply faster than other ones, and eventually they would overtake the faulty genes and you would have just the good gene, and now your blood cells would be circular instead of shaped like C's, and that's basically the problem with sickle cell.
And you also only need a certain level. And so if you reach that threshold, it's not that high.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be 100%,
right? It doesn't have to be 100%.
But the trick is, I mean, with cancer, like leukemia will kill you if you do nothing. So it's worth the risk to wipe out your bone marrow and try again.
Right.
But for other things that you can kind of live with, you wouldn't want to have to take that risk.
Right.
Do you know of any experiments or procedures with gene therapy or CRISPR or stem cell have been conducted in zero-based gravity, such as the International Space Station?
Well, not in people. Maybe in flies, but actually I'm not.
I know that people are definitely taking stem cells into space and seeing, you know, what happens, and if there are different... if they behave differently, and also animal models as well. And so those are being done. I don't know if anybody's done CRISPR in space, but definitely they are studying like how the cells behave, and they do behave differently, and also model organisms as well. Yeah.
Hello. How do you deliver the treatment, and how long do you expect it to take?
This is the real its challenge is delivery. And so you hit on it, like that's really how to deliver these therapies safely. And so the current strategies use a virus actually for gene therapy. And so these are actually, there's beautiful work for SMA. They're actually using a viral-based gene delivery strategy to cure children that have this devastating neuromuscular disease. And so a lot of gene therapy strategies since then have followed suit with delivering genes in viruses that are engineered to deliver this gene. And these viruses actually have tags on them that tell them to go to specific organ system. So it's actually pretty cool and has now been shown to be safe and has been used clinically for a number of diseases now. So gene therapy has exploded. So how do you take the knowledge that we've learned with gene therapy and move it to CRISPR? And the challenge with moving CRISPR forward with viruses is that one, you're making a permanent change in the DNA, and you want the protein that does that to get in, to do its job, to cut quickly and then leave. You don't want that protein sitting around and cutting anywhere else in the DNA. So this is a challenge with using viral-based strategies to deliver the CRISPR machinery. And so a lot of research is being done right now on how to do it in a more transient manner to avoid having any off targets, any cutting in any gene that you don't want it, because you really want it to do its job and leave. And so that's really the challenge, is how to deliver this safely and specifically at your specific, for example, patient mutation with Duchenne. And so the other way would be a stem cell-based strategy where you take the patient cells, you make an X stem cell, and then you CRISPR correct there. And that's safer because you're not delivering the machinery to the body. You're delivering it to cells. And before you put those cells back into patients, you can test them. Are there any off targets? Did any other gene get? So that's really the safer way. And so then you deliver those cells back to the patient. The challenge for muscle is that muscle is at least 40% of your body. And so how do you get cells to every muscle is not easy because they're not blood stem cells and they don't migrate and they kind of get to muscle and stay there. And so that's a challenge we're faced with in the lab that we are currently researching to try and get these stem cells to multiple muscles in a more efficient, but you hit it. It's a big challenge.
You know, you've kind of alluded to this in terms of the problems if you're affecting different genes, but, and I could be totally wrong, I had always thought that genes often work in combination with other genes, and that we don't know quite what the interaction is, so that if you do something with one gene, you could very well be affecting something that you had no idea you were affecting. So you haven't mentioned that at all, so I just wanted to maybe I just want some clarification.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. So genes often work in networks. And so you often have one master gene that sits and does a job at this site in the DNA, the genome, if you will. And this is bringing in complexes of other genes that come there. And so you're absolutely right. And this hasn't been really evaluated, that by just targeting one gene, we might, you know, be thinking about, we could disrupt other interactions that are these other proteins that are coming. And so it's something that as scientists, we call it the 3D genome. And so, you know, our DNA interacts in loops and to get compacted into the cell. And so how different regions are talking, I think, is an important question. And so you really do have to think about when you target one gene, what's happening. In our case, you know, we're targeting to restore, you know, a protein that's missing. And so I think less about that. But when you're targeting specific genes that control a specific cell function that is going to bring in other complexes, it's an important question. And you're right, they do work together.
My question is basically, knowing how governments operate in militaries, if the genes are delivered via viruses, isn't there a chance the military could weaponize that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that it's, you know, as a society, we have to think about you know, carefully documenting what we're doing and showing the pros and cons of any technology. And so I think this is something that, you know, we have to monitor. And I don't know, you know, of any efforts to, so I think there needs to be more regulation on this area.
Well, I don't know if this would be comforting or not, but there's a lot of easier ways that the government or military could carry out biological warfare that are simpler than using CRISPR. So that might be the thing that would stop them from doing it. That's a great note to end on, huh?
Yeah. I want to thank both of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you all for being here. Take care.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.